Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape.
Welcome to Whitley on Wine. My guest today is Tom Gamble of Source Napa Valley. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm very well, and I wanted to say, first of all, I've been dying to have you on the show. we had this scheduled a few weeks ago, and it fell through. You were a little bit under the weather, but, I want to tell my listeners that one of the reasons I've been anxious is, first of all, I like your style of wine. You make well-balanced wines, and you make wines that express terroir, wines that that really taste like they came from someplace specific. They're not just your typical cookie-cutter wines. And also, you have an interesting story. Your family, I was thinking about this. I was looking at the year, turn of the century, all this. Your family has been growing grapes in the Napa Valley for almost 100 years.
We've been farming for almost 100 years. We were actually rather late to grapes.
Oh, okay. Farming. But yes. You've been there for a while. 1916, I think I read.
That is right. That is when my grandfather followed his older brother to the Napa Valley.
So, okay, why don't you tell our listeners, before grapes, what did people grow in the valley?
Well, we had all sorts of things. Truck crops. We had contracts for both the state mental institution that's still in Napa and the state veterans home to provide all sorts of things, from meats on our property. There was a slaughterhouse to grains and also fruits and vegetables. So a little bit of everything.
So what led the Gambles? And I should note that, your name is well known in the valley, not just among the vintners there and the other farmers there, but your Gamble Ranch Chardonnay has been a staple with the Behringer folks for many, many years. So anybody who's followed Behringer for any length of time has seen the Gamble name out there.
Sure. Particularly right now, it goes into the private reserve, but Ed Sobrazia, under his own label, emphasizes that it comes from our property.
Sure. Now, what led your family then to move away from the other things they were doing, or maybe they didn't abandon it completely, but to go into grapes?
Truly a matter of economics. I come from a real farming family, and perhaps you have to have a screw loose or just be very dedicated and passionate to be a farmer, because it's a very hard business. And grapes just started to pay more. Immediately previously, we were growing hay and cattle on what are now our grape vineyards. And I was about 11 years old when we made the transition, and it was during the big planting boom of the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was a function of economics. My grandfather did have, at that time, about a 50-year-old head-pruned Petit Sirah vineyard, which, alas, is no longer.
Well, there are a number of stories like that in the Napa Valley where grapes like Charbono were mm-hmm. grown. Things that, you still see, the odd bottling of, I don't mean odd in a bad way.
No, I understand.
The occasional bottling of Charbono now, but it's not popular. And I guess there was Riesling in the Napa Valley at one time.
Oh, I remember I farm a piece of property in Rutherford that used to grow Riesling for both Rutherford Hill Winery and Freemark Abbey,
yeah,
as well as Gewurztraminer. But I think those are extreme examples of where we've made better planting decisions in the following generations.
Yeah, I would think that that Riesling in the Napa Valley today would only thrive maybe in the southern end of the valley where it's a little cooler.
Riesling, really needs, I think, a Region 1. I think we can make some pretty good Chardonnay down in the south end of the valley.
Mm-hmm.
But I would pound the table for maybe some more Charbonneau and some of the older heritage red varieties.
Now, do you grow any of those?
I have some Petit Sirah, which is now resurging.
Now getting popular again.
It's becoming, I wear just my farmer's hat for that. It all goes to Bialy, Robert Bialy,
mm-hmm.
And hope to one day have some in my own lineup.
Yeah, Bialy's well known, actually probably best known for his Zinfandels. But,
that is correct, but he also has a Syrah line and makes some pretty
Since you bring up the Petit Syrah grape, mm-hmm. It has gained in popularity recently, and I think part of that is the wine's more approachable now than it used to be, because Petit Syrah was always known for its very aggressive tannins, and it still has a lot of tannin, but the wines are, like I said, they're much more approachable now. And I'm curious, is that a function of something that folks are doing in the vineyards, or is it a winemaking technique?
I think it's a little bit of both, Robert. I think it has to do with the fact that overall we have a lot better viticultural techniques, and we have healthier vines than we used to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the past our vines had a lot of virus in them, which didn't allow them to ripen fully.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a good thing or a bad thing. But it's stress is a good thing to a certain level, and then you start to fall off. It's the same in folks.
Right. And so you weren't – when you're not getting the grapes as ripe as you would like, you're going to have more aggressive tannins.
But or you'll just have – they just won't be quite as balanced. And
mm-hmm.
some years they could be way underripe. And you also have, and so you're going to have very high acidities, which particularly with Petit Sirah can give it kind of a menthol-y, kind of a cough syrupy sweet a taste. There's some sort of a sour cherry taste in Petit Sirah if it's not ripe enough. Now, that's not to say we should always go to the extreme ends and make wines that, when I was younger, were considered port as far as their alcohol content
sure.
go. So it's all about balance, and it's all about finding the right healthy balance for the vines and take some of the burden off the winemaker. Then the winemaker has to use techniques that don't accentuate the tannins, use the right barrel selection, etc.
At what point in your lifetime did you make the decision that you were going to make grapes and the wine industry your career?
That's interesting. I guess the second semester of my year at Davis, my freshman year, and I was able to get into a partnership of guys who took a hops field in the Russian River Valley, and we planted Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and we rode that for about 10 years, and then we were offered lots of money, which we thought was lots of money at the time.
and at the time, it probably was. Today,
it
maybe
was.
No.
And,
yeah.
And so we were able to pay off our college bills and what have you, and get our lives started as adults, and starting to find out that we didn't want to be bachelors all our lives, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, I think, my first adult activity. You know, I spent summers moving irrigation pipe and doing whatever my dad wanted me to do, and always looking forward to doing it.
Tom, we're going to have to take a break. But when we come back on the other side, let's talk about the inspiration for Source Napa Valley, okay?
Will do.
Whitley on Wine will continue following these messages.
Skin me a peach, say. Peel me a grape.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
I'm chatting with Tom Gamble of Source Napa Valley, and Tom, I guess up until about the year 2000, your fame was in selling grapes to other people. You already mentioned Robert Bialy, but Paul Hobbs, a famous winemaker, Nickel & Nickel, really successful high-end winery. What made you decide to go to the other side of the fence, so to speak. I mean, you're still growing grapes, obviously, but to make your own wine, and then the big thing, you have to try to sell it after you make it.
Oh. Right. Well, I think the inspiration was, is I thought I'd like to be able to try it myself. I also saw that I was also thinking it was a nice diversification thing. And I also, frankly, wanted to try to get the extra margin that you get from making and selling wine. As everybody is probably aware, Napa Valley land prices are only doing one thing, going up, and they've averaged a 9% increase over the last 40 years each year. Mm-hmm. And so it still makes sense to buy land given the returns as a winery, but it gets harder and harder to justify buying land and increasing your farming operation unless you're getting that extra margin. So there was the business side of it, plus there was the passionate side. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say the sustainability side, and the sustainability in that I wanted to have that extra margin because I have lots of little nieces and nephews, and I want them to have the opportunity to go into the business and be able to sustain themselves as I have.
Now, you also have a particular philosophy that, you know, I guess relates to the name, Source.
Mm-hmm. Our grapes are... coming up with the name, my partner Bill Davies and I, he has since gone on to other things, but we wanted to have something that related to where our grapes come from, the land, the dirt, the terroir of Napa Valley, and it's also where we're from. We're both homegrown kids here in Napa Valley.
Yeah, you know, when you and I were chatting over lunch one day, you were talking, though, about even, you know, small blocks within a single vineyard really have a lot of meaning to you. And you wanted to do something to really highlight the aspects of specific terroir, even within a single vineyard.
Yes. For instance, I think we were chatting about a Merlot block that is perhaps 20 years ago would never have been planted because we didn't have the right rootstock technology to really tame the serpentine soils that are in this particular block. And it's a small swale. And with improving economics, you can look at smaller and smaller units versus typical farming where you basically have to look at a few square miles to make any money. So we're looking at a small block. It has three different exposures in this little Merlot block, and the two sides are shaded. The little swale has more sun and more intense soil, so we have three different rootstocks in there. And we're only talking about something that's less than an acre. And we actually have and three different clones as well. It makes the work a little more complex to take care of, but I think that you tasted some of the results and some of the red wines we had that day.
How much wine? How many barrels or how many cases can you get out of an acre?
Well, that is the big question.
Of course, it depends on your yields.
And it depends on how you farm.
Yeah.
And if you're going as a straight commodity farmer, you say in the San Joaquin Valley, those guys want to get 20 tons an acre.
Mm-hmm.
I'm striving to be in the 2 to 3 ton range.
Yeah.
And so a ton of grapes, but then a great ton of grapes can be squeezed. And the harder you squeeze, the more you get, but the more bitterness you get at a certain level. So the higher-end wineries, we're not unique in this, will only have the free-run juice, will have their free-run juice, much like virgin olive oil, and they will also then perhaps keep their press lots separated from their free-run juice. And perhaps a little pressing might add a nutty characteristic or add a quality, but too much will lead to bitterness and other things that may not be desirable qualities in your wine.
You know, when we got together, we tasted a number of wines, and I was impressed. They all had their own personality. They had tremendous personality.
Thank you.
And I think one of the things that we discussed is, you know, there has been a trend, there's no secret about it, to go for riper, jammier wines. And it's my feeling personally, that you lose a little bit of that individual personality when you get too ripe, because then all of these wines start to taste alike. Because they have that dominant characteristic, which is ripeness and jamminess, and not necessarily the characteristics of the vineyards. But your wines are all in. How do you maintain, or how do you strike that balance?
Well, we basically just don't hang them as long as some of these other folks may do. And that's not to criticize them. They may have their own successes, but I just don't believe it's sustainable. There's lots of competition out there. You got to let the vineyard speak.
Mm-hmm.
And the vineyard isn't really speaking if the grapes are underripe, and it's not really speaking to you if they're overripe. And I know I'm sounding a little esoteric, but
sure.
You're sitting out there and you're looking at the vineyard, and you know how it's speaking to you, and at a point the grapes look like they're at their full maturity before they start to then decline. Now, it is in this decline phase, when they start to shrivel and raisin, actually, that is when these really ripe, jammy wines, that's when they start to get picked. As mm-hmm. a straight grower, I have concerns about this because there's been demonstrated weight loss in the grapes, and you get paid by the ton. Let's
yeah.
say. So your revenues actually go down. Well, I think if I want raisins, I'll go to the grocery store.
or grow raisins, yeah.
And this is where the business starts to become art, is when to pick. And it is a time of some anxiety and also excitement in our lives in the fall when we make this decision to pick the optimum time to pick a certain block to get the essence of what that block it offers, or what you think it offers. And we take, and I mentioned before, if these blocks have slightly different exposures or slightly different soil, the picking time may be different. With the Sauvignon Blanc, it's only 12 acres, but we pick it 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And because they just offer just different nuances in each one of those little sections.
You know, there's another aspect of this whole idea about balance that I'm kind of focused on right now, and that is the freshness that you get in a wine that's more well-balanced. Because when you get riper fruit, you tend to get a heaviness that a lot of times when you first taste it, you go, yummy, and, you know, you get all kinds of interesting things like chocolate and, you know, or mocha, you know, depending on what your descriptor preference is. But you don't necessarily go back and have another glass of that.
Well, it becomes also very heady because of the higher alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to me is my palate becomes very fatigued. And for some reason, food doesn't taste as good. I do like having the right balance of ripeness and also fresh acidity in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about added acidity. I'm talking about natural acidity that doesn't get added in the wine. Another reason we pick multiple times.
Yeah.
The earlier picks are brighter, more on the lighter fruit side.
Mm-hmm.
It maintains that acidity, which keeps it kind of more up on the palate and more refreshing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's where the freshness comes from. Now, are your wines hard to find?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, boy.
We're working on that, but
yeah.
We're little guys in a very complicated market, and I can sell the heck out of grapes, but I'm learning how to be a wine salesman.
Now, can people who live here in California go visit your website and buy wines and have them shipped?
Yes, they can. The best way, I have to say that I don't have a very good website, but you can visit it, and you can also call us, and you can get our wines, and or come and visit us when you're in Napa. We're in the process of building the winery, but right now I have people sit around my farmhouse table and taste the wines, and then I take them for a little tour of the vineyard. So everything I've been talking about, they can actually see and perhaps touch.
Now, can they just pop in on you, or do they need to call?
Oh, they need to call because I might be running around in the.
Okay, so what would be the number that a visitor would have to call if they wanted to pop in on source?
707 968-9111.
9111. That's 111. And your website is sourcenapa.com.
That is correct. Watch for the Web 2.0 version coming later this year.
So talk a little bit about your wines. We only have a couple of minutes left. Why don't you run down your entire lineup? Quickly, though.
Our biggest claim to fame is our Sauvignon Blanc, the Gamble Vineyard, which we spoke about before.
Delicious. Nice minerality.
Nice minerality, yet complex, and has some of the and has elements of riper fruit as well as the minerality. Then we have the family home Oakville Cabernet. We've been making it for 5 vintages. It's 3.7 acres on the knoll top in the middle of Oakville. And it is just the essence of what terroir is all about. And it's called family home because it's where I grew up. Paramount is our red blend. We wanted to make a really good red blend. And I do not at this point grow all those grapes. But I get grapes from, I grow the Cabernet and the Merlot, and then I get a little Cab Franc from Carneros and a little Petit Verdot from Spring Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a Heritage Sites, which is also a red blend, and that is the new release will be a Zinfandel, Petit Syrah, Syrah, and Charbonneau blend.
Oh, there's that Charbonneau, yeah.
And you haven't tasted that one yet, Robert, so next time I'm in San Diego, I'll have to bring a bottle.
Or, you know, I may pop by for that little tasting by the table there, you know.
Please do.
You know, because I'll be up in Napa within a month or so.
I look forward to seeing you. And then finally we have a Syrah. We only make a couple hundred cases of it. The 2005 is the first vintage, but it's not the first vintage for these vines. They're 40 years old this year.
40-year-old vines.
Head prune, 30% frost damage in those old
guys. Now, we should tell people when you say head prune, it means it's not trellised.
It has no trellis and looks more like a bush than what you typically see in most photos
absolutely.
These days.
Anyway, Tom, I want to thank you for being with me today, for taking the time, and finally got you on the radio after we misfired a couple of weeks ago.
There you go. You
okay.
Take care.
Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine, saying until next week, ciao.
The buzz for my pillow.